Hi, everybody. My name is Melissa Campanelli, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Retail Online Integration, and I want to welcome you to today's live webinar, Cross-Border Trade, Where to Begin, and Best Practices for Driving E-Commerce Sales, sponsored by Channel Advisor. In today's webinar, Kent Allen, the principal of the Research Trust, a strategy and research consultancy that focuses on cross-border e-commerce, we'll first discuss the basics around how to start selling your goods overseas, covering the challenges you may face and how to overcome them. Then Mark Vandergrift, Director of Cross-Border Trade at Channel Advisor, will discuss best practices around how to generate demand overseas. Today, you'll learn things such as how to prioritize challenges to address and opportunities to pursue, to identify which products will sell best in which markets, to identify which entry models and partners that work best for their company, and to generate demand overseas using online marketplaces and international marketing programs. Before we get started, however, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can use all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time, so with that, let me pass it over to Kent Allen of the Research Trust. Take it away, Kent.
Thanks, Melissa. As Melissa mentioned, my name is Kent Allen. I'm a principal of the Research Trust, which is a San Francisco-based research and strategy consultancy. And really, over the last 5 years, I've focused a lot of research and consulting and thought leadership on cross-border commerce and international retail expansion. Really looking forward to sharing some insights today. First, I really kind of want to start by thanking Melissa and the ROI team for producing the webinar and for the Channel Advisor folks for hosting us. So just a quick overview today. I'm going to spend a little bit of time really kind of talking about the basics of cross-border e-commerce, which is, again, selling across borders and serving international customers. I'll start by exploring the opportunity to start selling internationally and then spend a little bit of time on merchandise, markets, business models, and really kind of how to manage your expectation. Then we're going to turn it over to Mark, who will speak to some agile cross-border trade stages and really kind of focus on how you can connect to demand. So without further ado, let me just dive in. So, you know, I wanted to start by kind of looking at the opportunity. Back in 2009, we fielded our first international e-commerce benchmark study, and in that study, we interviewed about 40 senior e-commerce executives, and often one of the first questions that we heard was, okay, so what's the size of the prize when it comes to global e-commerce? And at that time, there wasn't a whole lot of international market sizing information out there, and the opportunity, though, really intrigued everyone. Today, you know, that's changed. This slide is Forrester's e-commerce projections on a country-by-country basis. You know, I looked at a recent McKinsey study where they were projecting that 70% of all Internet users by 2015 will live in emerging markets. But, you know, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time today kind of dwelling on, you know, the size of the prize. And, you know, we see figures that range from anywhere from $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion e-commerce dollars by the mid-decade. Instead, what I want to do is provide some context on why the opportunity matters. So, again, kind of looking back to the study we did in 2009. At that time when we were talking to e-commerce executives, again, they understood the growing e-commerce opportunity, but they weren't really sure where it fit in their list of strategic priorities. And today, we still find a lot of e-commerce executives trying to figure out where e-commerce, where international and cross-border e-commerce fits in their strategic queue. You know, when we were talking to them then, one of the topics that came up was a lot of, hey, you know, we really need to focus on our U.S. market. We've just spent arguably a decade, you know, kind of battling to get the resources and the C-level buy-in for e-commerce. And again, at that time, cross-border really meant kind of shipping to Canada and maybe for the leading edge shipping to the U.K. So, you know, they had a very valid question, which was, again, why go global when we have so much untapped opportunity here at home? And to be honest, we didn't have a great answer at that time. Today, we have better answers, and one of the things that we really try to focus on is that the international opportunities is really kind of too big to ignore. the retail globalization is really kind of a growing trend that we see, and increasingly we see digital commerce as the tip of the retail globalization spear. So this is a chart from the latest Nielsen study that's called Spice Routes. They did it in conjunction with PayPal. And the colored arrows here, you know, they simply highlight the explosion of digital e-commerce trade flows all around the world. So clearly cross-border is no longer just about U.S. outbound. We're seeing online brands all around the world using digital channels to sell across channels. More and more we're starting to see investment in landed operations and in-country facilities around the world that are letting them fulfill orders, not just from their home countries, but increasingly from outside their home countries. So whether it's Amazon, you know, investing heavily to what, you know, some people are increasingly seeing as the global retail supply chain, or whether it's eBay becoming, you know, kind of marketplace or the marketplaces for the world, or even pure plays like UK-based ASOS or brands like Zara, really kind of winning global market share by going global. You know, the point here is clearly cross-border is here to stay. And the thing that matters most for the U.S. audience, especially the folks here on the phone today, is that, you know, increasingly the rest of the world is targeting the U.S. market. So when we analyze this opportunity, we're kind of really looking at the two key trends that I want you to think about today. Again, this rise of global retail competition, and then this reality that we're seeing a global middle class increasingly coming online and shopping what we're seeing, or what we're calling this borderless global shopping mall. So really back to the question, you know, why go global? Well, today it isn't really look at these amazing market projections. Instead, it's really much more along the lines that the best defense is often a good offense. Defending your domestic market is increasingly going to mean engaging your global competition on their turf. So you need to start taking the steps necessary to meet this competition on all fronts and to engage your cross-border shoppers. And so that's kind of really where we want to take the rest of the presentation today. So, you know, takeaway number one, again, is don't dismiss the cross-border opportunity and don't ignore the threat of the global competition. This is a quick slide from the Spice Route study, and really just kind of showing some of the most popular cross-border shopping destinations. Clearly, we see the U.S., the Hong Kong and China region, and U.K. as being leaders in the cross-border trade. Canada, Germany, Australia, also kind of a leading next tier when it comes to e-commerce companies that are seizing the day and going after cross-border opportunities. So again, remember that the world is now targeting your shopper. They're targeting the U.S. shopper. And interestingly enough, we're also seeing a lot of data that shows that the U.S. shopper is pretty much welcoming this competition. Some of the data in the cross-border study that's highlighted here, you know, points out that U.S. shoppers are really kind of looking both east and west. Almost 17 million U.S. shoppers last year shopped U.K. retailers. 13 million were shopping Chinese e-commerce sites. And both of those were more than the almost 12 million that were actually shopping Canadian online retail. So, again, these are still relatively modest numbers, but I think as you see more mobile commerce and cross-border innovation spring up, we're going to see more and more shoppers coming online. So eMarketer actually projects that there are going to be over 900 million digital buyers outside of North America and Western Europe by 2016, and that's going to account for half of the global e-commerce spend. So what are some other first steps that retailers can take? Well, let's talk a little bit about challenges. I often tell folks that we speak with, you know, don't get overwhelmed by the real or the perceived challenges of international expansion. Don't try to boil the ocean is kind of the tagline there. And there are lots of hurdles out there to overcome, so the best advice is to really just take it one step at a time. Find trusted partners, follow their lead. At the same time, don't get distracted by some of the arguments that, you know, we heard 5 years ago about, you know, battle for internal resources or pushes internally to focus on the domestic market. Yes, that's important. The U.S. market is attracting attention for a good reason. There's a lot of online shoppers and there's a lot of opportunity. But you have to kind of look beyond your domestic market. So often the first set of big challenges and to-dos that you'll run into are really along kind of the legal and regulatory front. And that includes, you know, foreign investment restrictions, taxes, intellectual property, privacy, trademarks. I mean, we could spend an hour just really addressing those. But, you know, don't have the time today. So want to kind of quickly move through these challenges and focus a little bit more on, you know, kind of challenges in and around improving the end-to-end online experience for the cross-border shopper. It's kind of ironic that, you know, we spent a decade investing to improve the customer experience, but by and large, that customer experience has really been for the U.S. shopper. It's time to really kind of think more globally. So a real key theme here is localizing the online experience for shoppers from different countries and different markets within those countries. I did a webinar last month where one of my guests, Frederico Torres, who's the CEO of Tratello, which is a network of cross-border marketplaces serving Latin American countries, had kind of coined a term that I really like, glocalization, which was really kind of used to describe the importance of, first off, localizing your communications, whether it's website or emails, localizing payment options, and really kind of localizing shipping. Pricing transparency is another one that's very important here, making sure that the total landed cost, and by total landed cost, what we're talking about is the final price to get an international order into the cross-border shopper's hands. Being able to kind of really present an accurate total landed cost during the checkout process can really help boost international conversion rates. Another area that, you know, we kind of see as challenges is the international shipping cost. So we're actually seeing a lot of focus on this now, and we all know the importance of shipping cost in the e-commerce success equation. So, again, we're looking at more and more folks that are focused on the opportunity to decrease international shipping costs. Especially we're seeing kind of this tier of single-lane shippers emerge that are able to provide faster and cheaper delivery, especially to some of the fast-growing emerging cross-border markets. So I'll wrap up the challenges slide by really pointing out, obviously, customer service is another big challenge you're going to run into. A lot of times the best way to focus on that or to kind of serve the customer service from a cross-border perspective is really to make sure you have end-to-end order tracking. It can be a really good way to not only keep the international shopper informed and happy, but it's a great way to reduce customer service costs, which can be, a big challenge when you're going international. Returns is another thing that sometimes is a little bit of a misunderstood challenge. You know, as you go global, you'll find that returns in some markets are really kind of an alien concept. I'm not going to say that, you know, returns aren't something you have to focus on because they are, but don't assume that, you know, any of these challenges are you know, kind of a deal breaker. You just got to kind of take it one step at a time and don't get overwhelmed. So you want to move quickly to, you know, kind of merchandise that sells well. And this is a pretty straightforward slide. I look at it really from two different perspectives. One is kind of taking an aggregate, all markets view. In other words, okay, what are the products that are selling everywhere well cross-border? And, you know, simply put, they tend to be products that make you look good or feel good. So clothing and accessories tends to really be kind of the number one, the clear leader when it comes to merchandise that sells well internationally. Other products that make you look and feel good, whether it's health and beauty or luxury products, you know, are certainly other products that we're seeing a lot of folks get traction with. Another way to look at markets or merchandise that sells well is to take a market-by-market approach. And that can typically reflect kind of the online maturity curve in those specific markets. So you think back to kind of what originally sold well online, well, certainly travel and things that Amazon would have sold in its first couple years of existence. And you do tend to find countries that are early on in their maturity curve as far as e-commerce adoption. You know, those products tend to sell well there. Whereas when you look at markets like the UK and Japan, where you know they're much more accustomed to e-commerce, you're actually starting to see some bigger, more durable products start moving cross-border. It wasn't that long ago that selling big, heavy products cross-border was something that people kind of advised against due to shipping costs primarily. You know, we're starting to see that change. So you know, just some kind of takeaways when it comes to deciding what to sell. Again, one smart step is to really kind of just focus on your top-selling merchandise. I mean, we see kind of an 80-20 rule here where your top 20% of or 20% of your catalog kind of is accounting for 80% of your sales cross-border. So, again, don't try to boil the ocean. Look at your data. Look at what sells well. Focus also on what your competitors are selling, both the competitors that you're going to be competing with that are coming from the domestic market or the country that you're targeting, as well as your competitors at home that are also investing in cross-border. Look at in-country marketplaces. You know, Mark will get in more into this later, but, you know, what's selling well in the marketplaces is going to give you some good clues on what you can sell with. So, you know, there's some other very basic, simple truths here is, you know, align what you sell with who you are and who your customers are. And that sounds obvious, but we see a lot of sellers that get tempted to expand beyond their core merchandising strategies when they move into new markets and see new opportunities. So watch out for that. You know, the other thing to make sure you pay attention to is, you know, what are the local tastes? What are the local product preferences? You know, you do have to do your homework. And often you'll find markets, you know, that with opposite climate patterns, for instance, where you can sell merchandise at full price instead of liquidating it. You know, so outdoor gear being a great example there. I want to move on now to kind of markets. It's kind of interesting when we talk to people that are planning their cross-border, their international strategy. Sometimes it's almost like they're planning a family vacation. They're like, oh, where can we go here? So let's spend a few minutes on where to sell. Again, I'm going to kind of keep it very straightforward and very kind of, you know, how to get going type advice here. And again, look at your international traffic and your order flows and really follow the money there. What this will typically do is take you to the English-speaking countries, Canada, UK, Australia. Australia is an interesting one. Although it's a smaller market, you know, we've actually seen some data, some early data from our latest international study. We've got a study in the field right now where we're talking to about 20 or so international e-commerce platform providers. And what we're seeing is when we ask them, you know, where are the hot markets, you know, Australia continues to kind of pop up. And, in fact, it received the most votes of any country in the very strong growth category, which is 25 to 35% annual growth. So, you know, once you kind of move beyond kind of the first simple steps, you know, the slightly more advanced approach is to kind of, you know, do your homework again, do a deeper analysis, you know, pay attention to the macroeconomic fundamentals. I mean, Latin America gets a whole lot of attention these days, you know, in large part because Brazil is such a big opportunity. You look at some data, it would suggest that Argentina and Venezuela would be good markets. But, you know, you look at it from a macroeconomic lens and you realize that, well, you know, actually Chile is probably a better market down there. It's just there's easier to do business and there's some opportunities. Credit card penetration is another one that's really important to pay attention to. Again, you know, we tend to sometimes think, well, it's e-commerce, everybody's got a credit card. But, you know, in lots of markets, credit cards are just, you know, not something that people like. In Germany, for instance, the bank transfer is a big payment option. So you need to pay attention to, you know, credit card penetration, but you also need to understand that there are going to be a lot of other payment preferences in the different markets. Broadband adoption, you know, kind of a no-brainer. You know, certainly start paying much more attention to where you see mobile commerce adoption because that's going to really define, you know, kind of one of the next stages, I think, of cross-border. And, again, the cultural propensity to buy online that we've spoke to already is important. So, you know, no presentation is complete without a Mary Meeker slide. So, you know, this one is really kind of calling out some countries where we're seeing some good growth. This is the top 15 international markets in year-over-year internet growth. And, you know, obviously the U.S. is right there around number 10. But, you know, notice that the BRIC countries, so Brazil, Russia, India, China, you know, these countries are still under 50% when it comes to population penetration of the internet. So we looked at some of our survey data yesterday, and again, we found that China and the Hong Kong markets continue to really experience the most explosive growth of any of the markets that we polled. And by explosive growth, we're saying, you know, 35% plus. So, you know, lots of opportunity continues, not only in the BRIC countries, where we're seeing Russia really kind of get more and more attention, and obviously Brazil, especially with the World Cup and the Olympics coming, and even India, which is a little bit more moderate, but starting to kind of come on people's radar a little bit. You'll also hear a term, CIVICS, which stands for Colombia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Egypt, Turkey, and South Africa. This is kind of a block of emerging international markets that you might want to watch. I mean, one of the interesting things about these markets is that they're often kind of gateway markets to really fast-growing regions in the Middle East and Southeast Asia and Latin America. So this next slide is really just kind of a quick reminder that you're going to, you know, as you move beyond kind of the English-speaking countries, which will probably be your first markets to focus, you're really going to need to anticipate trade-offs. And this is really just kind of a reminder that, you know, you'll see the countries in Western Europe and North America where it'll be much easier to do business kind of there in the lower quadrant. And you're going to have to kind of, you know, look internally at the trade-offs that you're comfortable with when you chase after the kind of higher growth countries, which tend to be in the top boxes there. Those higher growth markets are going to continue to be attractive because, you know, they tend to have a lower cost to serve customers. There's less competition, although, again, that's starting to grow. Again, I mentioned they're often gateways to larger markets. And typically you see an abundance of natural resources. The education is kind of moving beyond the elite. So, you know, won't spend much more time on that. Want to move to some models here before I turn things over to Mark. And this is a slide that came from our 2009 study. Again, kind of a very simple framework that was was really kind of articulating a key finding from our study, which was instead of there just being kind of an all-or-nothing international expansion mindset, which, to be quite honest, was what traditionally prevailed among international strategists, you know, only, you know, even 5 to 10 years ago, we were starting to see this kind of new strategic options, which we called the participatory stage. The passive stage was really this idea of pretty much doing the minimum to serve international and cross-border shopping, whereas the active was much more of the all-in strategy, you know, which really involves significant global investment in landed operations. And so I really kind of want to focus the kind of wrap-up section here on this emergence of this middle stage of international e-commerce expansion, which we call the participatory stage. And this, again, was what we saw was this emergence of, you know, kind of a group of solution providers called sell and ship providers, international e-commerce platforms, international shopping carts, you know, a wide range, which I'll break down on the next slide a little bit. But really what they were offering online retailers is kind of a lower cost, lower risk model to kind of test the waters of international, if you would. So, again, back to my earlier point, find good partners and follow their leads. That's really kind of the focus of the participatory stage. So, you know, what we're seeing is today more and more options within the participatory option, and I just want to spend a few minutes on this one. You know, up in the upper left-hand corner, the idea of outsourcing to a third party, that's probably one of the, you know, kind of one of the more popular trends right now. So that's working with companies like Border Free, Pitney Bowes, you know, we'll look at Bongo and Global ShopX and International Checkout later. You know, there's a whole host of hybrid cross-border technology and logistics companies that are coming online right now. So there's a lot of opportunities right now to work with third parties that bring kind of the technology to bear. You know, we're also seeing over on the right side, within the participatory, we find some companies that really kind of have a mixed portfolio, we call it. And often that's country-dependent. And what we mean by that is that in some markets they might work with a third party, but in other markets they might have a complete hands-off due to some restrictions on, you know, tied to franchising. You know, they've pretty much, you know, released their own right to sell direct. And, you know, the interesting thing is we're starting to see companies that are not able to sell direct into some markets start to kind of revisit those contracts and really kind of pull those back as the contract. So, you know, recommendation there is revisit, you know, where you have opportunities to, you know, kind of sell direct, and if you don't, you know, revisit some of those contracts. In the lower right-hand corner, international marketplaces is an increasingly, you know, kind of big option. Again, I'll defer to Mark on a discussion around that. You know, another model that we also see is kind of the portal market, you know, kind of sign up and get a U.S. shipping address so that it looks like you're moving along. So, you know, I want to move to the kind of final slide here, which is managing cross-border expectations. And just some kind of wrap-up data points here. I wanted to give you guys a few data points around traffic and sales from international. And, again, this is coming from some initial findings that we found. We see a pretty wide range when we ask, you know, what's the annual increase in traffic from international shoppers. And, you know, where we see, you know, kind of a conservative benchmark emerging around 15 to 20% growth. Sales a little bit lower than that, probably, you know, benchmark around up 15, so 15% growth. We also asked for the first time kind of international traffic from smartphones and tablets, and what we found there was that it tends to reflect right now what we're seeing as far as domestically, so somewhere between 20 to 30% of traffic coming, international traffic coming from smartphones and tablets, much like we see in domestic market. And international orders a little bit less than that. So, you know, with that opening, I'd like to kind of turn things over to Mark. And Mark's going to really kind of speak to what I think is probably the most, you know, fascinating next stage of cross-border, which is really kind of how do you, once you've built this ability to kind of accept and fulfill orders, how do you generate international demand? So, Mark, take it from here.
Hey, thanks very much, Ken. I appreciate it. So here at ChannelAdvisor, we work with retailers and brands of all sizes, and increasingly we're hearing questions about how they can reach foreign consumers. We've also heard stories from those who have tried already to do so, and frankly, they've had varying degrees of success. And our advice to all these sellers is pretty straightforward and somewhat reflects what Kent was saying earlier, and it's really best summed up in two parts. The first is, despite your best planning, you should expect to get things wrong, and therefore expect to need to iterate and constantly make adjustments. So don't overcommit. And instead, start with the smallest investment possible, and then learn, put those learnings back into your next phase, the next phase of your expansion. And then second, when planning, always focus on demand. Put demand at the top of your priority list. Some of the challenges that Kent mentioned earlier, like logistics and payments, localization, those are the challenges. They're all definitely valid and things that need to be solved. But no matter how well you solve those challenges, if no one buys your products, you're not going to see a return on your investment. So tapping into existing points of demand really is the best way to maximize the possibility that your investment will result in profit. And so we combine these two ideas into really a demand-centric, experiment-oriented concept that we refer to as agile cross-border trade. And it's intended to be a framework of how an e-commerce business might move into selling across borders and eventually reach full market entry. And I want to go through it briefly as I have the types of demand in the rest of the presentation organized with these phases in mind. And these phases will definitely vary somewhat by business, and it may even vary by region for the same business. You may skip a phase. You may have several iterations of a single phase. And, you know, as Kent talked earlier about some of the phases in his study in the past, and these are a little bit different. So I want to go through them so that you can understand them clearly. The first phase is what we call passive. This is really when consumers are doing more work than you are. Your business exists really only in your home market, and shoppers are coming and finding your existing presence either on your own site or if you're participating in domestic marketplaces, finding those listings, and you're basically shipping products to wherever they happen to be. The second is what we call active, where you're making an effort to actively engage in new markets without really launching a local website, so using online marketplaces or potentially using local marketing programs to drive traffic to your U.S. site. Next, we often recommend creating what we call a light version of a local site, meaning if you have a very expensive or complex site domestically, kind of spinning up on a more simplistic and hopefully less expensive platform, a site with basic core functionality in your target countries, and then the last phase being a full site launch with all the bells and whistles of your local domestic site. So how do you go about applying this framework as it pertains to demand? The first thing to understand is that the regions and even the countries within each region can vary different. They can be very different. They can vary in terms of consumer behavior and certainly in terms of the sites consumers use to shop online. And you can see that reflected here in this chart. For example, that the blue slice in the North American pie chart there, which is marketplace activity, is about a quarter of e-commerce activity. And that same blue section in the Asia-Pacific region is about three quarters. So while most of that activity in North America happens on eBay and Amazon, a single marketplace called Tmall, which is owned by Alibaba, drives more than half of the business-to-consumer e-commerce in China. So in general, many of the big internet names in the U.S. have little or no market share in Asia. Meanwhile, Europe looks a lot more like U.S. So some of the biggest destinations on the internet for consumers to shop on are names you are already familiar with, like eBay, Amazon, and Google. But there are also local marketplaces and also comparison shopping engines and other sources of demand as well. So I'm not going to go through all these in detail, but the point here is that these variances really need to be appreciated. And because of these, it's really not enough to have just one overall plan for expansion, though it doesn't mean you shouldn't have one overall plan. You should, but it's important to have a different plan for each region or group of countries, depending on how you decide to group them. A lot of U.S. businesses will group U.K. and Australia and maybe Canada together initially because they obviously share a language, although there's certainly localization differences to keep in mind. So in addition, you should definitely, you know, some other cross-border planning tips, definitely do market research. Kent kind of touched on this. Going out to sites like eBay and Amazon in or Tmall or whatever the local points of demand are in those regions and investigating what's already selling is definitely a good thing to do that. In terms of expectations, you know, you should be aggressive and obviously want to succeed, but be realistic in terms of sales and what you can achieve. And again, keep demand at the forefront of planning. So now I want to go into some of the specific opportunities to connect to demand outside the U.S. And again, I'd like to speak to each of these with regard to the structure discussed earlier, starting with the passive opportunities. If you recall, this is when you're, as a seller, taking advantage of demand from abroad that has, you know, come into your existing presence in the U.S. So Kent touched on this a little bit. I want to start by talking about the variety of companies that can help convert traffic on your U.S. website. So you can go and do marketing into other countries and bring them to your U.S. site. But what I'm talking about right here is just kind of harnessing the existing traffic and kind of greasing the wheels, if you will, for these international shoppers. So these three, Bongo, Global ShopX, International Checkout, these are three companies in our partner network that help the conversion. Some of the things they offer include displaying prices in the shopper's local currency, allowing shoppers to prepay their duties and taxes. They also provide solutions for sellers in terms of logistics and also fraud prevention. So if you already have a significant percentage of traffic coming to your site from abroad, this definitely could be an option for you to help get a better return on that traffic. If they're only seeing prices in their own, in U.S. dollars, and it's not set up for conversion for those folks, you're probably missing out. What we also find, though, is that a lot of U.S. sellers who have their own website don't really have much traffic coming to those sites. The U.S. sites tend to get that most traffic from abroad are those with significant product assortments and kind of better recognized brand names, such as Amazon and eBay, for example. So I want to talk about some of the offerings from those companies that sellers can take advantage of. So first, eBay and their global shipping program. So this is a program where if you're a seller on eBay, you can ship orders domestically and have eBay handle the international leg. And it includes more than 35 countries. I know they just added Russia fairly recently, which Ken mentioned earlier is a market with a lot of e-commerce potential, though it's definitely relatively underdeveloped right now. This next slide shows the consumer experience for the global shipping program, in this case with regard to the UK. I didn't see that showing up for some reason, so I just kind of skipped over it. But we have hundreds of sellers participating in this program, and they are seeing some pretty good sales. We've seen sales from at least one sale from every country that participates in the global shipping program or that is included by eBay in the global shipping program. But as you can see in this pie chart, it's highly skewed towards English-speaking countries. Canada, 62% approximately. Australia, 22%, UK. So a very, very large portion of the sales going through this program are going to English-speaking country, which I think just kind of reflects that many consumers in across the globe still really want to participate in e-commerce in their own language and shop and buy in their own language, and that's what they're comfortable with. So even though I'm referring to this as a passive program, I don't want to imply that eBay is just kind of sitting back and waiting for traffic. They're going out and acquiring traffic in international markets, these listings, and displaying these listings on local sites where they have them, and even auto-translating the homepage and other parts of the eBay.com when a consumer comes from a place where there is no local eBay site. So again, Russia is a good example of this. You can see in the screenshot here a Russian-translated version of the eBay.com homepage. They also are participating with some retailers' existing sites in China to try to generate interest there, generate demand. They also have a global deals page where they take the deals that are available on eBay.com that are shippable outside the U.S. and just show that subset of deals on that page. They recently announced they're entering Brazil. They're launching a mobile application there, and they don't have a localized Brazil site. But the overall message here is that eBay is very active in cross-border trade, and if you're not already participating on eBay and you're looking to experiment with cross-border trade, I think eBay is a good platform to look at. Amazon will also allow non-domestic shoppers to buy from products sold by retailers on Amazon, where the seller has indicated they're willing to ship abroad, either ship themselves or through Amazon's Fulfillment by Amazon program. They are definitely less aggressive in terms of acquisition of that traffic as compared to eBay, but through the FBA export program and the international shopping options they have, which is reflected on this slide, they can ship to 65 countries, which is almost twice as many as the eBay program. So they do have pretty good reach in terms of their distribution or their fulfillment capabilities through FBA. And for those transactions, the consumer does pay the estimated customs, duties, taxes, et cetera, and then Amazon will provide a refund if it turns out that they've overpaid. So, again, these are ways to capture demand from abroad without actually taking action directly abroad. So now I'd like to talk about programs that fall under what we call active. So I mentioned earlier that eBay is very CBDC-focused, cross-border trade-focused, and because they have what I refer to as an open platform, meaning each seller and buyer connection is really independent and just facilitated by eBay, they're a good place to consider starting with regard to active cross-border trade. And this is kind of in contrast to conventional wisdom around, and I certainly in general agree with the conventional wisdom, but what we're seeing is eBay will allow sellers to post items directly onto eBay UK or Australia or France, et cetera. And because it's this open platform that I'm talking about, they aren't required to communicate the fully landed cost. And what's interesting is that we're seeing a lot of sellers start to list directly on these sites without posting the fully landed cost and just basically communicating, here's the product price and the shipping price, and any customs duties, et cetera, are the responsibility of the buyer. So it's definitely not the ideal user experience, but we are seeing some sellers get some activity, some decent sales, and some of them are doing so through eBay's program called the International Selling Program, which really is invite-only, but really it's attractive because they're providing some incentives and some assistance with content localization costs. So this is different from the Global Shipping Program. The Global Shipping Program is U.S.-only, and those listings on the Global Shipping Program are only on eBay.com. This involves, like I said, active cross-border trade where retailers are actually posting onto eBay, Germany, France, et cetera. And within this program, like I said, there are content localization assistance options. But because eBay is this open platform, we've seen sellers list directly to eBay Germany and France without translating their content, or sometimes just translating their terms and conditions, sometimes just translating the titles to try to get better placement, but not the entire description. So there's a lot of openness and therefore opportunity to experiment on the eBay platform. Amazon also offers some programs that are helpful. One is called Jumpstart, which I don't really think they consider a cross-border trade program, but we consider it one, and that's because it's intended to help sellers get listed on Amazon quickly with minimal investment. So it could be a good option for those looking to enter the European market. This is offered in all the European countries that Amazon participates in. In contrast with eBay, though, it's not an open market. Their user experience is a lot like a traditional e-commerce site where all of that, all taxes, duties, those sorts of things, all costs to the buyer do have to be communicated in the price on Amazon. So they also have a couple other functions in their software. One's called Expand Listings Internationally. Another one's called Build International Listings that are available to EU in EU accounts. And those are also similar to Jumpstart. They're really intended to help get up and running in other countries for what they call in-catalog products. When I say in-catalog, I mean items that are already available for purchase or at least in the catalog from Amazon, and you can easily create an offer based on that just by dictating a price because the content is already localized. There are many other marketplaces across the globe. I mentioned Tmall earlier. A lot of these have significant traction. Mercado Libre is the dominant marketplace in Latin America. About, I think, one-third of all Internet users in Brazil are registered Mercado Libre users. And actually, Channel Advisor just announced this morning that we've entered into a partnership with Mercado Libre and added support for their Brazilian marketplace to our platform. So we're very excited about that. But, you know, in general, when you are looking at expanding into other regions, other countries for the first time, marketplaces are a great place to go because consumers are already shopping there, especially in some of these emerging RIC countries. So once you decide to launch a local site, like I said before, we usually, you know, suggest a conservative investment, both in the site itself, but also in how you connect to demand to drive traffic to your site. So I want to talk about the different options for connecting to demand when you have your first site launch in a local region. So I have the term low risk in quotes here because in marketing, there's always some risk, no matter what you do. But we try to guide people to take lower risk opportunities. For example, cost per acquisition programs like affiliate marketing and some remarketing programs as well. Email marketing, as you start to build up a base, there's certainly some cost there, but, you know, once you have someone buying from you, remarketing to them and trying to get them to repeat is definitely a good area to focus on in the early going. Social media, again, I have this free in quotes because social media definitely takes time and investment, but there are ways that you can communicate with sellers and research what people are interested in buying and try to reach out to them and let them know what you have available. In the U.S., social commerce has been kind of a hot topic, but it hasn't really borne a lot of fruit. What's interesting is that in China, it is documented that it's a pretty significant part for many consumers in terms of their shopping process. So if you're interested in expanding to China, you probably will need to participate in local social sites there. Google Shopping has a pretty significant global footprint, and it's a CPC program, but based on our experience, it's still relatively low risk in the sense that because there is a price and an image and a title and just general information about the product being displayed before the click, the conversion rate seems to be pretty good, and conversion rate is obviously a very important function when you're dealing with a CPC program. It's going to be a direct it's going to directly correlate to your profit. So even though Google Shopping is a CPC program, we still usually recommend getting involved with it relatively soon after launching your initial site because the conversion rate can be so good. And then finally, when you do decide to launch your full site, you can start to wade into more quote-unquote high-risk opportunities. You know, paid search in general is not necessarily an extremely high-risk opportunity, but when you're talking about advertising on keywords in other languages that you may not be as familiar with, other cultures, it can be a lot more risky than in your domestic market. I've got Google and Bing listed here. Google has a very significant footprint across much of Europe and other parts of the world, but they're not a player in Russia, where Yandex is very popular, or China, where Baidu is the primary search engine. And then general display advertising is certainly an option in all these places. You know, it's a common advertising type across the internet, but it's really better for brand building in general than it is for driving direct sales. And I would say really the same is true with paid social options as well. So again, understand that these are higher risk advertising types when if you're just getting into launching a site into a local or a new market, it probably makes sense to avoid these in the short term until you feel like you've learned enough and you can reinvest those learnings into building these types of campaigns. And that is all the content I had prepared. I want to thank everyone for joining us.
Great. Thank you guys so much. Thanks, Mark and Kent. You went through a lot of great information, and I want to remind all of the attendees that this presentation will be available. So if you wanted to catch any of the stats or any of the questions or any of the points that the speakers brought up, that you will have access to it. This is the time during the presentation where we encourage folks to ask questions. So we do have a few questions that have come in, and I'm happy to ask them, but I just want to remind you that you have two experts here in this very hot topic of cross-border trade. So please, if you have any questions, please send them over. We're happy to answer them. The first question that came in was really around like the tax issues. Kent, I know you briefly mentioned it. And I also know that during the presentation, several sort of companies like Boingo, international, I guess you could call them service companies or fulfillment companies, were brought up. Do these folks also help with like tax issues, or do you have to go to another vendor or anything like that? Or is there sort of a list of vendors that can provide this kind of consulting?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different ways to, I had mentioned, step number one often is getting a good partner, and I probably should have said getting lots of good partners. But, I'll kind of start from the commerce platform. So we are seeing more and more of the leading commerce platforms, kind of create APIs and other integration agreements with, what we'll say next up on the stack, which would be kind of the international e-commerce platform. So both of those, whether it's, somebody like a Demandware or somebody like a Border Free, you can definitely find partners of theirs that focus specifically on the taxes. Interestingly enough, one of the big challenges, if I was doing this conversation for a, kind of a predominantly, Western European audience or something like that, one of the big challenges for them is often like, oh, my gosh, how do I deal with all the different state taxes in, 50 different states as I'm trying to come into the U.S.? And I know, Mark, didn't you guys have, it was in Meridian that was maybe at Catalyst? Those guys are very, very interesting when it comes to kind of, a pure play, if you will, that's focused on tax. So, the answer there is that you can kind of find the help on the tax either by going directly to kind of a best of breed provider of that. But typically the international e-commerce platforms will also provide an opportunity for you to kind of connect with those type of solution providers. And increasingly we'll see more and more of the e-commerce platforms also provide kind of links and programs that connect you with those type partners.
Would you agree with that, Mark?
Yeah, I was going to mention Meridian Global Services. They're a partner that ChannelAdvisor works with, and they're really solely focused on helping businesses that do business in multiple countries comply with VAT regulation. They're a great partner of ours. They've been a partner for multiple years, and we recommend them to all our sellers, really, who are interested.
Yeah. Great. Excellent. We have another question that came in, which I'm sure would be an important question, especially if you're trying to sell international to upper management or the CEO. What would be a reasonable amount of time for, say, a mid-sized U.S. brand to expect to, you know, build some brand and some sales success in the U.K. specifically? Either one of you guys can take it. I know, Mark, you talked a lot about driving sales overseas, so...
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer it. I would say it's always going to vary, you know, in terms of the product type and what other brands are popular and what the characteristics are of those brands and whether or not your value proposition or the characteristics of your products really kind of suit the needs or the tastes and preferences of the target market. Obviously, it's a very vague answer, but there's a lot going on in this question. We have sellers who sell branded apparel, and they can get traction immediately. If you're selling, let's say, Nike shoes or something like that's already known. If you're trying to build your own brand, then I would expect the timeline to be significantly longer. And I think that if you're going to try to build a brand in a new market, really the brand building is probably going to have to come before the expectation of sales. So, a lot of what I talked about is connecting products that already have some sort of interest from the consumer base in the target market into places where they're already looking for products that they want. This question, it sounds like, because it's using the term brand, is more about entering into an area where that type of product is already sold, but yours, has a different brand name on it. And doing that is, I think, significantly more challenging and, like I said, requires an investment in brand building with almost no expectation of sales. So depending on, whether it's apparel or consumer electronics or whatever it is, the specific approach is going to vary, but I would say it would take at least 6 to 12 months to start to get traction from that perspective.
Yeah, and I think Mark kind of nailed it. I mean, there's a couple different ways to tackle this question. One, the good news is that typically what we find is the kind of mid-sized, mid-market specialty retailers tend to be ahead of the rest of the pack when it comes to cross-border. And part of that is because, unlike bigger brands that may get slowed down a little bit by, whether it's the brand police or other kind of internal silos and channels and things like that, some of the mid-sized guys, especially the mid-sized pure plays, can move a little bit faster. So we didn't talk a lot about org design today. That, especially for larger organizations, that's really kind of something that I probably should have put on the challenges list, because a lot of times kind of getting your org design straightened out, not just for omnichannel but for international, is almost like step number one before you try to move too quick. The other piece that Mark touched on was it really depends if you're an established brand. If you're an established brand, more often than not, you're going to be able to get a good feel for, kind of what the brand equity might be in different markets, like the UK. So you're going to be ramping up a little bit faster if you're a known, treasured brand. If you're building your own brand, that's going to take a little bit more work. And that's, kind of to Mark's point about looking at social and things like that. Social would be kind of a pretty cost-effective way to kind of, accelerate the kind of brand building that you need to do. But, yeah, I think six to 12 to 18 months is kind of something reasonable to look for, especially if you're kind of a new brand.
Okay, great. We still have about 10 minutes, please continue to ask the questions, but we do have another one. And I guess I'll direct this one to Mark, because, Mark, you mentioned Google Shopping in one of your slides. Have you found that retailers in the U.S. are using Google Shopping in other countries to drive traffic to their U.S. e-commerce site? So maybe they're using it almost to test whether or not folks are coming, or can you talk about that at all?
We are seeing it done. I wouldn't say it's rampant, but we are seeing it done. The reality is that Google has some pretty stringent requirements just for participating even within the domestic market. And, for example, those are that the content that you're sending in your feed or through the Google API has to be in the local language. So if you're a U.S. retailer, that takes, out of the 15 countries that support, it takes like 9 of them off the table right away unless you're willing to translate your content. In addition, the price in the local currency has to be in the feed, and it has to match the price on your site, which means if someone sees, you know, 10 pounds or 50 pounds as a product price in Google Shopping in the UK, and they click through and it says, you know, $75, it's possible that Google will identify that as a mismatched price and will pull down your listings. Now, you can use technology to, you know, change that price dynamically, which is great, except that since exchange rates fluctuate, it's hard to get them to match exactly. That doesn't mean that you're definitely going to get pulled down. If it's relatively consistent, then you may have the opportunity to keep those programs up for a while, but there are certainly risks. My suggestion is, you know, do it with caution. Make sure you're updating the data very, very frequently. And before you even start to think about it, make sure you're able to show the local price on your site when the retailer clicks the link.
That's a good point. I'm sure people, you know, it's one of those things that I'm sure people don't even think about. Let's see. We have another question that came in, and it is about, can you talk a little bit about China, Mark? This person is interested in selling online through, you mentioned the marketplace Taobao in China. Is that challenging? Yes. Would you recommend it? Is it for a specific type of vendor or type of product?
So I mentioned earlier that marketplaces in China are really where consumers go to buy products. Mm-hmm. It's actually really challenging to launch a local website in China and get any sort of traction in terms of bringing traffic to it. So the reality is, from a seller perspective, because so many consumers are there, it's extremely competitive. And Tmall is, you know, again, it's more than half of business consumer e-commerce goes through Tmall. But they also have, because there's so many sellers on Tmall, they have lots of advertising programs within it. And if you don't participate in some of those advertising programs, it's actually going to be pretty challenging to get consumers to see your listings and you know, to generate any sales. So Tmall is kind of a beast in that sense. It's not, you know, not that doing business on eBay or Amazon in the U.S. or Europe is, you know, takes 5 minutes. It still requires effort. But Tmall likely is going to require even more effort because, like I said, you can't necessarily expect to just put listings up and have them be visible. Even if you have good content, there's a lot of activity there. There's a lot of listings. And so getting traffic to those listings is going to require participating in some of these advertising programs. And we've heard some kind of, let's say, unverified metrics that there's as much advertising on Tmall as there is in Baidu, which is, you know, has a program a lot like Google AdWords. So they have a lot of revenue coming to their business, Tmall does, just through the advertising portion, not even the transactional portion.
Mm. I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's Tmall, right? I'm sorry about that. Okay, another question came in during that answer, and this is a listener who actually works for an established brand, and she's interested in penetrating Australia, and she kind of wanted to get some feedback as to whether or not one of these marketplaces platforms is the best way to go. I guess wondering if those marketplaces are hot in Australia, or should she do it solo? And kind of, you know, Mark, I don't know if you want to take it or yeah. Maybe you can chime in too, Kent. Or
yeah. Why don't we let Mark take it, and I'll kind of come in with some comments as to what we're seeing.
Yep, that's fine. So I would say Australia definitely is a great market because. You know, it's not huge. It only has about, I think, 20 million population approximately.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's undersupplied as compared to demand, and they it's an expensive place to live, so they're used to paying, you know, good money for items. Prices here, product prices in the U.S. are usually lower. They do wind up paying a lot for shipping because obviously it's very far away. But they only have to pay tax if the item is over $1,000 Australian, and it's approximately, you know, a one-to-one exchange rate, so approximately $1,000 US. So because of that, since they're willing to pay for the shipping and you know, don't have to pay additional tax, and the prices in the U.S. tend to be lower, it's actually really attractive for them to buy from the U.S., and I think, you know, Kent mentioned earlier that he's heard a lot of positive things in his studies around growth in Australia, and I'm really not that surprised to hear that. From an e-commerce, a domestic e-commerce perspective, I would say that a lot of the kind of established retailers are significantly, you know, at least a couple of years behind the United States in terms of understanding how e-commerce works, having a good strategy. Obviously, there are outliers. You know, there's some good business in Australia. Amazon does not exist in Australia. eBay does very well there. So I would say, you know, it really depends on kind of, I mean, I understand you say you're an established brand, but I still don't know what product type or how strong the brand is. If you think that there is demand for your products, if you think people are going to places like Google and eBay and other points of demand right now and searching for your brand and want to buy it locally in Australia, then I definitely think it would make sense for you to, you know, test with eBay if you don't want to invest too heavily. And, you know, and this is a case where maybe the like I said before, the stages of this program or this framework that we talk about can vary. If you have an established brand, it might make sense to go directly to the light site portion and start to harness traffic, you know, queries for your brand on Google and take them directly to your site and see what kind of conversion rate you can get.
We just got a note that the listener actually sells knitting products.
Knitting products. Okay. Well, I don't know a lot about the knitting product category. I would say you can use some of Google's market research tools to go see what you think what the volume is or kind of a relative volume is of queries on your brand in Australia versus the U.S., and that might give you an indication. You can also go and see if anyone is currently buying your products, importing them to Australia, and then reselling them locally. eBay would be a good place to look for that. You know, and then what you find in doing that market research would really dictate the next best step. But again, if you feel like people are out there running searches for your brand, I think you could, you know, pretty realistically get involved either with a light site or maybe just testing with eBay.
Yeah, you know, I would basically say, you know, that is exactly the answer. It's like, you know, look at both options. You want to, you know, set your U.S. site up to, you know, to support cross-border, so international shipping, and you definitely want to have a presence in-country marketplaces where, again, eBay is kind of the leader there. So really taking a two-pronged approach. If part of that question is I can only do one, which should I do? You know, I think actually you should probably – tough. I'd probably start with eBay, but really push to make sure that you're able to kind of ship because, again, you know, knitting materials are one of those, you know, kind of easy to ship internationally. It doesn't tend to be, you know, too heavy from a weight perspective. Mm. Yeah, the other thing that we're – big picture what we're seeing in Australia is, you know, great example of you know, kind of, again, this is high-level kind of critique is – you know, in many cases, the Australian retail world is a little bit behind the times. They haven't necessarily been the most customer-centric, you know, again, from an industry perspective. And instead of, you know, kind of investing in e-commerce, they've actually tried to, you know, kind of take legal measures to lower the amount of duty-free imports that Australia. So, you know, they're kind of fighting the wrong battle right now, and I think they're coming around to it a little bit. But I know 2 years ago that was probably one of the top cross-border topics was just like, you know, the embedded traditional Australian retailers just kind of really not getting it and not understanding that, you know, e-commerce and cross-border is here to stay and is growing. So, you know, the best thing to do is if you're an established brand, you know, hit it on both fronts. Make sure that you can, you know, your U.S. site can sell and serve cross-border and get a presence up as quickly as possible on the market.
Okay. Great. Well, we really just have we only have another minute here, and I want to close out, but there is one more question I just wanted to make sure to ask, and that is there some sort of an online resource or something? I know we talked about, using your fulfillment providers or whatever, but is there like a resource to locate the necessary country-by-country like business requirements for doing this? Or
I think that's mean establishing the – I take that to mean establishing a local business entity in the different markets. And really each country, you know, it varies pretty significantly. In some places it's not that hard. In places like, frankly, Brazil is not very easy. Places like Japan and China are not very easy. The local government site is going to be the really the only place that I would fully trust. If you definitely want to invest, you definitely want to go down that route, it might make sense to locate some sort of consultant that specializes, but they're probably only going to specialize in a local region. There's not going to be one person or even one website that can tell you everything you need to know 100% accurately about creating a business in every country on the planet.
It's kind of one of those, you know, take it one step at a time. That was why I tried to lead off with, you know, don't be overwhelmed by the challenges, whether they're real challenges, perceived challenges. You just kind of have to start one by one. You know, a lot of times, in fact, one of the questions that we asked in our survey that's in the field right now is, you know, who are you turning to, especially when we were looking at, say, international marketing and things like that. And, you know, the best advice is probably to turn to your U.S. partners, whether that is more on the kind of legal and regulatory side. So, you know, talk to your lawyers and accountants and consultants on that front. If they don't have international expertise, you know, they should be the ones that can at least direct you in the right direction. So, you know, work with them at first. And then when it comes to kind of more the, you know, kind of blocking and tackling of the online purchase experience or the international marketing side of things, you know, turn to your existing partners, whether it's your email or search provider on the marketing side or your commerce platform. I mean, that's certainly one of the things that we've seen, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years is the commerce platform community really kind of understanding the opportunity and, you know, kind of doing their best to kind of line up resources and things like that. So that would be my suggestion.
Great. Let me just end too. Would either of you or both of you like to just give out your email addresses if anyone has any follow-ups, because we're having such a great dialogue here. I'm sorry
to
end
sure.
it.
Yeah, my name, you know, my email is it's kent.allen, so kent.allen@researchtrust.com. And, feel free to reach out, and, you know, we can kind of help you navigate the wealth of resources that are out there.
Mm-hmm. And, Mark, did you want to?
Sure. Mine is markv@channeladvisor.com.
Okay, great. Well, it looks like we're just about out of time for today. So on behalf of Channel Advisor and Retail Online Integration, I want to thank you all for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And please also take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next. We'd be very grateful if you could do that. Your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. And I hope to see you at our next ROI webinar. Thanks a lot, everybody.